Father.
May it please the court. Today, the court is here to decide whether attorney Carl Smith's law license should be disciplined for making false statements against the 44th Circuit presiding judge John Moody, Douglas County Associate Circuit Judge Craig Carter, Ozark County Prosecutor Tom Klein, Wright County Prosecutor Jason McPherson, and Douglas County Prosecutor Chris Wade.
Now, does Mr. Smith have any other prior discipline?
He does not.
And what's the ABA say about that? This is a special case where you disbar him on allegations like this?
If it was one instance, like, well, Madison was a couple instances, and Coe, I believe, was one instance, probably not. But this was a pattern of practice that went on for 18 months. This was after our office had asked him to stop doing this. This was after he had consulted with the Ethics Council, and she had told him, don't be putting this stuff out in these affidavits unless you verified it in some way. He didn't verify it. He went ahead and put it out. And he didn't just put it out in pleadings where there would be very little chance of the general public seeing it. He distributed it in voter information packets. He sent it to the newspapers. He sent it to the Springfield television stations. He wanted it known throughout.
Do we know anything? Has he ever, do we know in his record, does he have any instance of mental illness or of any other mitigating factors?
I don't believe that there's any history of mental illness. I believe that there may have been some history in the past of drinking issues, but he contends that those have been resolved for many, many years, and that was a very short period of time during his life.
So the pleadings are one thing, as it's 8.2A, and it's very, very serious. But the voter guide stuff, once you get in the voter guides, I know affidavits, et cetera, but what I see in elections is that if a lawyer is involved in an election, do they have a higher standard than someone else who's involved in an election?
I would think so, very much so, because the public views attorneys as someone that's knowledgeable about the law and somebody that would uphold the law and do what's right, and he was putting out information that was false information.
Does White versus Minnesota address that at all or no?
I do not know.
Let's start talking about the First Amendment issues. Would you get into that, please?
Well, Mr. Smith asserts that his activities is protected by the First Amendment. We assert that it does not. We believe that first, that what his, this is really conduct instead of speech. And in support of that, we cite to N. Ray Coe and N. Ray Madison, which in both of those cases, this court did say, this is conduct, not speech. And in Mr. Smith's case, I think it's conduct because you have to look at it as a big picture. There was evidence that he had a very strong dislike for Judge Moody, Dan Wade. Chris Wade was Dan's son, and some of the other people and the attorneys, and he was also, it didn't come out a lot in the trial, he was also angry because Judge Moody had testified in his friend John Ruffett's criminal trial, and this was just a pattern of practice where he was trying to harass these judges and prosecutors because he was angry with him. Oh, and Chris Wade had beat him in an election as prosecutor.
Well, and in the voter information packet, didn't he even emphasize that he was giving these people this information as an officer of the court?
I don't know in the actual information packet. Some of that was just distributed to voters, and he had different places that they can come and pick it up. But when he sent it to the Fair Board, yes, he did. He said that he was an officer of the court, and it was his duty, I believe, for him to spread the word to the public of these facts. He said facts, not unsubstantiated accusations.
And was everything he said untrue?
Yes. Well, there was on Dan Wade and Pam Brayfield's affidavit, Dan had gone to Pam Brayfield's son's house and removed his son from that premises. Pam Brayfield's son was a known drug dealer. That did occur. It did not occur in the way that was in that affidavit, but the rest of that information, yes, all of it was false.
Now, in Culver and Madison, were they both disbarred, and did they have any prior disciplinary action before that?
No, they were not disbarred. In Coe, I believe that their original recommendation was a suspension, but in the opinion, the original opinion, there was some talk from two of the judges that if she apologized that they might, they would have looked at this differently. She promptly made a apology, asked for a rehearing, and then she was given a reprimand. And in Madison, I believe that he received a suspension.
In Buzz Westfall's case, in which he now I assume you said it was conduct about his saying that the Court of Appeals was intellectually dishonest. Do you recall the Buzz Westfall case?
Yes, I do.
And I think he got a public reprimand, which I think he appealed. But he was a public official. He was the prosecutor of the largest county in the state of Missouri. And I think that was upheld at some point. And you consider, but he was not disbarred. He was
I think the difference reprimand. From that case is that was one instance. He was clearly angry about the decision. I think it was a little different and was angry and probably spouting off of...
You still disciplined him.
Yes, he was disciplined. In this case, it went on for a long period of time, multiple instances, and I think the allegations are much more egregious. To say that basically you're upset and you don't think the judge did a very good job of deciding an opinion is different to me.
What else have we disbarred people for this kind of speech?
I don't know that you have. There haven't been very many cases.
We had one last week, Todd something. It was one last week we accused the judge of violating, but that was a default. He didn't show up for the hearing. But you have not disbarred anyone else for this kind of speech before?
We haven't disbarred. I'm not aware of you all disbarring.
But we disbarred. Where else do we disbar people?
We don't receive these. Fortunately, there's not very many of these cases.
So this would be a first one.
Yes, and I think the reason in this particular case that you should look to the DHP's decision where they commented that Mr. Smith showed no remorse and they had very serious concerns that if he wasn't disbarred that he would continue to do this practice.
Was there any harm? I mean, there's terrible harm to the system and it's evil things he said and he clearly can't lie about a tribunal. It's all there in the rules, no question. That these are violations of the rules, but was there any harm caused to the to emotional or physical harm to the judges, to the accused of these horrible things?
Well, Judge Moody made the panel for the Southern District, and I know that he testified that he was asked by the governor.
But isn't that pure speculation as to whether that had anything to do with it or not? I mean, being at the public embarrassment of making the allegations is very real, but whether... It would surely be speculation.
It would be speculation. I don't think that we could probably call the governor, and the governor wasn't going to testify as to whether or not he picked or did not pick Judge Moody.
Have there been any civil actions against Mr. Smith regarding libel or slander?
There were lots of litigation going on when this first occurred. Basically, everyone was suing everyone down there. I think all of those were ended up
but
being
dismissed.
But did the
dismissed. Judge sell Mr. S- file suits against Mr. Smith for libel, slander, defamation?
I do not believe that Judge Moody or Judge Carter did. I'm not sure about Dan Wade. Again, there was lots of litigation going on, but I know if anything was filed, it was all dismissed at one time.
Can you address further? I know you said it's conduct, but it's statements that were made at speech, but at some point it's treated like conduct. But can you address that dichotomy and when these statements should be looked at as speech and therefore subject to strict scrutiny?
I think the difference is, like in Mr. Westfall's statement, he was actually commenting on something that the opinion that the court had issued, and that was his purpose. I don't think that was the purpose of Mr. Smith's. Mr. Smith's purpose was to harass these judges.
And that makes it conduct? What do the cases say? When is this considered conduct as opposed to speech?
Basically, the disciplinary cases I found on this talking about conduct were the Madison and the Coe cases, and those are not particularly explained as to what the dividing line is between conduct
but
and speech.
But you're saying we're past that line here. Why should we look at this as conduct? If I understand your brief, you have two arguments. One is even if it's speech, there's strict scrutiny, there was reckless disregard for its truth, and it was in fact false, and therefore he should be disciplined. But you have a separate argument that it was conduct and therefore it has to meet a lesser standard, and I just want you to explicate that argument for us.
Again, I'll probably be reiterating what I said. I wasn't doing a very good job, apparently. I think that it goes to his purpose. In Westfall, his purpose was to express his displeasure with the decision. In this case, he was targeting these prosecutors.
What was his purpose of doing so?
He wanted to embarrass them. I think he wanted to try to get them criminally charged for some of this stuff. I think he wanted them to resign.
Or he wanted to prevent them from being reelected.
Yes.
What, do you have any other precedent from other states? I mean, there's election cases, judicial election cases throughout the United States. Do you have any other cases in which, I'm sure there are, where one candidate said this about that candidate and charges might have been brought. Do you have any other cases around the United States where for the first violation of the code, I mean, this gentleman has not had any other charges against him, they have been disbarred? What other cases have people been disbarred on for election assertions?
Elections assertions?
Right, elections.
I don't know about election assertions. The two cases I cited in my brief, one of which was where at Louisiana, where the attorney was angry with the prosecutor. I believe the prosecutor had brought charges against him, and he then went to the prison and got a prisoner to sign an affidavit saying that had been hired by the prosecutor to kill someone in the past.
What other elections?
I'm not aware of any in the as far as elections.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask a question about Chief Justice Teitelman's characterization about this being this gentleman's first offense. These allegations, which were found to be true, were strung out over a course of 18 months. Mm-hmm. Is it fair to say that if Mr. Smith hadn't continued to pile charges on himself, that these could have been all brought separately and independent, and that if they were done that way, then there may be a record of prior discipline? But the fact that this kept going on, you were trying to stop him, you were trying to warn him, actually drug it out to where finally it's everything's up against the fence at one time.
Yes, very much so. And part of the reason there was some delay in this particular case, there was a federal criminal prosecution going on with Judge Wall. There was other matters, and John Bruffett was criminally prosecuted in the state courts, and then these contempt actions, so we usually try to let the waters clear of any of the criminal prosecutions before we go forward. But yes, very much so, if he continued on this.
Any more questions? You have an opportunity to move on. Thank you. How many years has Mr. Smith been practicing?
I believe it was around two decades, I recall. If it may please the court, I think the issue here is not whether Mr. Smith violated the ethical rules. I think that he did. Nor is the issue whether or not he should be sanctioned. This court should. The real issue here is whether this court should skate along the thin ice of First Amendment jurisprudence in reaching its conclusion that Mr. Smith violated the ethical rules or whether this court should avoid that.
Does White versus Minnesota give us some guidance?
Yes.
And how so?
White against Minnesota, the judicial canons prevented judicial candidates from announcing positions on the law. It's called an announce clause. The United States Supreme Court struck down that provision of the canon, stating that because the announce clause deals with public speech in a election setting about the qualifications of a candidate, that is not the role of the government to decide whether that speech is acceptable or not.
But this wasn't an announce clause matter or announcing positions on issues, according to what was found by the DHP and what's asserted here. This was statements made with reckless disregard for their falsity, and nothing in Minnesota v. White says anything about that, and okays it that you cannot be sanctioned for making statements that either you know are false or you make with reckless disregard for their truth.
Yes, and the reason why the White case is mentioned in the brief is that I point out that Rule 4.82 does not have a provision that requires the statement made be false.
I understand that, but here, in fact, everybody concedes it was false. So I understand you think we should knock out the rule entirely as opposed to interpret it to require falseness. But here, if we take the if we disagree with your argument that we have to strike the rule as unconstitutional because it does not explicitly require falseness, and we get to the question of whether or not we're barred from prohibiting false speech or speech made with reckless disregard, do you have an answer?
I really tried very hard to follow that question, and okay. I'm sorry that I didn't follow it.
You're saying because it doesn't say it's false, it has to be false in the rule, therefore it's an unconstitutional rule.
That's correct.
And if we reject that argument and we say it's implicit that it has to be false, or we say here it's conceded it was false, so you really can't raise that claim, then what is your point? Then what
okay.
is your argument?
There's some points that I want to raise. First, the case in terms of speech goes far beyond Mr. Smith. It goes to any other candidate who is a lawyer or any other lawyer that's making statements that might find themselves out of a profession.
But they make false statements. They're lawyers. They have a higher calling. Maybe they shouldn't be in the profession.
Well, that is the point that the disciplinary office has raised, and one that maybe the court can take issue with. In the context of litigation, I certainly understand treating a lawyer differently from the average citizen in what statements can be made. The Gentile court decision stands for that. However, in political discourse, lawyers routinely run for offices that are held by other lawyers. It seems to me to have a rule in which a lawyer cannot speak with the same freedom as another candidate who is not a lawyer or another citizen is not a lawyer is a mistake. A lawyer's access to the courts, knowledge of the systems, understanding of whether there may or may not be corruption or competency issues may be of value to the public.
But the rule simply prohibits you from making knowingly false or in reckless disregard of the truth, statements that you make in reckless disregard of their truth. And how does that further any discourse?
Well, it has to do with how the rules are set up for citizens and the rules under First Amendment analysis and the rules that are set up as the disciplinary office hopes for lawyers. The subjective malice standard would be the standard for a citizen that is making a comment about a public official. That is not reckless disregard. That is whether the person making the statement had serious doubts about its truthfulness. That protects citizens throughout.
But affidavits without being checked, without going to all these different the TV stations and all the rest of this without any kind of checking before doing so is may be considered reckless, which is what the DHP is. How many? Let me get back to Judge Fisher's very good question. How many violations of the code did he make? In your opinion, how many violations of the code is reflected in that 18 months? Which you're admitting you violated.
In my opinion, and what we presented in the brief, is that we were asking the court to find the one major one, which is the crux, in our view, in the case, and the de novo review, of what Mr. Smith did wrong. Mr. Smith subsumed Mr. Jarrett's beliefs, or not beliefs, I guess statements, into Mr. Smith's belief system. And as a result of that, for the most part, this conduct is about Mr. Smith.
There's something wrong with the belief system? You said, what's this belief system stuff?
Oh, because Mr. Jarrett was convicted of perjury, I don't know if I phrased it correctly. Mr. Smith believed a lie presented by Mr. Jarrett is a better way for me to say it than belief system. And Mr. Smith subsumed that into Mr. Jarrett's litigation, presented that along with other
most recently in the public domain, a public figure, a lawyer, was told by someone, inoculations causes mental retardation, because the person told her that just before she was before the microphone. She said, this person just told me mental retardation is caused by inoculation. Would that lawyer be subject to discipline because she is a lawyer and she relied on whatever someone told her right before she went, and she'll say that, I mean, before she went to the microphone?
Well, that's why we're asking the court not to impose a First Amendment scrutiny or consider this a case where speech is at issue, precisely because what is the break here for when lawyers get punished while advocating for another human being that's their client?
But they're not supposed to lie for their client.
No.
That's against the rules.
That is
right,
true.
Rightly so.
But as we pointed out in the brief, Mr. and I think the DHP also pointed out that they did not believe, they could not say that Mr. Smith knew that the statements were untrue at the time that he made them. We admitted as a matter of law they were untrue because at the time of the perjury case. But look at the position then of a lawyer who is a prosecutor taking a single witness case of a witness who has made inconsistent statements and presents that case, maybe against all reason. And then what is the difference then between the lawyer who does that, the prosecutor who takes an 18-year-old allegation based on a single witness and presents that case, from the situation of an attorney representing a defendant who receives affidavits and statements, particularly more along the lines of, particularly in this case, Mr. Jarrett's statements about the interests of the people that are deciding his fate? And is the lawyer going to then be questioned by this court? And
so you say there's only one violation. Only one violation of the code. Is that correct?
The conflict of interest rule. Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Well, let me ask it another way then. As I understand, you're asking for a de novo review there, which I understand we can do. But if we took all the allegations that were found by the DHP, including those that they found the standard of recklessness, which I understand to be the constitutional standard, are there any of those findings that aren't supported by the record?
Any of the DHP findings that are not supported by the record.
Right. And by that, and most of those, I understand several of those were based upon a standard of recklessness.
Correct. But in terms of what facts the DHP found, no, there wasn't any fact that they found that was not in the record.
Okay.
So
when you made the comment about the one particular instance, your comment was based upon your advocacy position that we get to review these facts de novo, and that you're willing to concede that one, not necessarily the others, even though they're supported by the record. I guess they found more allegations than the one that I interpreted you to concede.
That's correct. And the I think that's an important point that the court makes. Again, the whole position that we are presenting is that at baseline, this is how Mr. Smith represented Mr. Jarrett. He had a conflict of interest. He put his interests ahead or along the lines of his client. He lost perspective, and he presented Mr. Jarrett's case in an inappropriate manner. For that, he should be
punished. You say there may have been a number of incidents, but they all arose out of his failing to his taking everything his client said as true and to heart and proceeding from there, as opposed to keeping the distance he should have had. But
yes.
Although I'm not clear why that's a conflict of interest as opposed to a failure to investigate, whatever his cause may be.
The failure to investigate, Mr. Smith took the position that taking the sworn affidavit from these reporters was enough for verification. There is some support in the case law that gives an affidavit some greater weight than just an ordinary sheet of paper.
Well, you're doing it under oath.
It's taken under oath and verified. And we cited that in our brief. And Mr. Smith did admit that beyond going through the verification process, he did not further investigate. Again, the question is, in the future, when a lawyer receives a sworn statement from someone in the course of litigation, does the lawyer take a risk in losing their license and presenting it if it seems relevant? And what I point out in the brief is that Mr. Smith knew the people that the affidavits were written about. They dealt with those people in his career. And I don't think that we can say entirely that portions of the affidavit were not verified in his mind, because much of what was said were dealing with relationships that he knew about in his
mind. But many of the facts he knew nothing about. Certainly these allegations that in fact were false, he certainly could not claim that he knew were true based on his knowledge of the people, because it's admitted that almost all the allegations were scurrilous and unfounded.
No, Mr. Smith did not. As the Office of Chief Disciplinary Counsel stated, he did not state that he made false statements. He stated and admitted in his answer that Mr. Jarrett's statements were false because he was convicted of perjury.
But you're trying to say he had a reason to believe them because he knew the people and therefore knew they might be true. But in fact, he's not claiming they're true.
I believe in his sworn statement or in his testimony, I thought that was what he said. I thought he was not backing off his statements except for Mr. Jarrett.
He's still not apologetic in regard to any of these allegations, with the exception of the one.
He is not apologetic about his beliefs. And that was the point that I wanted to make about probation in this case. And the reckless standard is a lesser standard under the ABA sanctions than knowledge.
What would probation give us? We're saying, we'd say you're on probation, so don't lie while you're on probation?
Well,
you want him suspended, stayed. How many years would you want him suspended under probation? What's your recommendation?
My recommendation is as little suspension as possible.
But under probation,
as an officer of the court, I think the court can place 5 years probation on him. And here's
once you're a liar, you're always a liar. I mean, how do you put someone on probation for acts of lying?
The McAllis case cited in respondent's brief, where the lawyer did get disbarred for making statements outside of Nebraska constantly. What was different about that case than this is that while the disciplinary proceedings were going on, Mr. McAllis kept up with his statements. That didn't happen with Mr. Smith. As soon as the contempt charge was done, he was shut down in terms of his statements. He respected the law while
he was in
the
jail.
Contempt case
was
over.
Was he in jail for a period of time?
Well, he went to jail, too. Right. And while this proceeding has been going on, no statements from Mr. Smith. You can't change his beliefs, Your Honor, but you can modify his future conduct.
What kind of conditions can we impose to protect the public in the future?
conditions of probation would be not to make statements about the people who were listed or subject to the informant's complaint. The court would have the ability to restrict his First Amendment speech. It would have made findings as to those people. It's common in criminal cases to have a no-contact provision, so there's no associational rights. That would be an aspect of it. Perhaps a requirement that he write a statement that exonerates these people, if that's what the court wants.
Don't a lot of your arguments you've just been making depend on our using a subjective standard? And in fact, in the past, we've used an objective standard. Would a reasonable attorney believe these things were true, as opposed to you're saying he had a false belief system and we should look at it from his point of view and realize he didn't intend this badly? But that would be a change in our approach, wouldn't it?
Well, the Buzz Westfall case employed the objective standard, which we urged in our brief for this court not to use. The question remains as to if the court follows the Westfall standard, which we argue was wrongly decided, was whether to use the clear and convincing standard. There's also the impact on the administration of justice, which we haven't talked about.
So would our former colleague Mike Wolf have agreed with you on that in Buzz Westfall?
That's right, Your Honor.
Thank you. Any more questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Now, do we have a serial prefabricator? How many violations do you say he had?
Well,
Give me a number.
At least four, and it depends on how he distributed the packets to at least 240 some people, and then plus the newspapers and all that. So this went on for a long time. And Mr. Galloway said, well, hey, when these proceedings were going, he stopped this. You don't have to worry about this in the future. The fact of the matter is, when this first started, we brought him into our office, we took his deposition, and we said, what in the world are you doing? Stop this. And he continued to do it. So I don't think that you can have much belief that he won't turn around and do this again.
Do you think probation would be I would think probation doesn't do anything. It's like probation if you're on drugs or alcohol, you can...
I would agree totally.
Don't do it again, but you think it might, because he might do it again, and probation might...
Probation's not appropriate unless you're going to have somebody sit beside him 24-7 saying, Mr. Smith, I don't think that's a good idea. Mr. Smith, you need to check this out. Probation works well for people that have practice management problems or drug or alcohol.
But you're not sitting with people to make sure they don't drink or they don't take alcohol.
Well, I mean, we do send them in for periodic testing of that. We check to see whether they go to AA. There's ways of monitoring that. There's no way, as like you said, a liar is a liar. It's a character default. It's hard to correct that.
Now, when you get to the point where you said you accept your client's statement, some of the best criminal lawyers, I think the best criminal lawyer in St. Louis in 1972 in an ABA meeting said he never wants his defendant to tell him whether they did the crime or that they were guilty. He tells them right from the start, I don't want to know that. I just want to know what your story is. But they don't want to hear whether they think they're guilty or not guilty, because that might put them in a bit. And so they take the client's story and they go forward, and then the prosecutor may prove them wrong and that the client's lying, or there's a conflict in facts. When does the lawyer, by putting forward their client's story without necessarily because they're advocating for their client, go across the line and saying, well, when do they have to say, I have to verify whether they're telling the truth in every situation when I'm looking at the criminal case?
When it's making false statements against judges and other legal officials, because that affects the whole system.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, more questions?